Welcome to The Connection, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. Do vampires exist? Humans who turn into bats and fly at night? Drink the blood of other humans? True or false? What do the Zetas have to say? And I quote from Zeta Talk on vampires, written September 1995. Vampires exist, but they're not in human form, as legend has it. The Earth has evolved creatures, mammals, that bite and drink blood, the vampire bats that plague certain tropical countries and debilitate range cattle with blood loss. Are vampire bats the basis of the vampire legends? In a manner of speaking, as the legend is based on a similar creature that evolved on another world, brought to the Earth by aliens in the service to self orientation to terrify humans they hoped to later recruit into their ranks, large vampire bats were brought to Earth. Then why the legend of the bats becoming human? The visitations occurred at night as these bats evolved in a similar manner to the Earth's bat, using squeaking sounds and a type of radar, and using the safety of darkness to escape predatory birds, which consider rodents a full-course meal. The imported bats were large, though slender. When flying, they looked like bats, but after they landed, their folded wings looked like outstretched arms. The vampire in his black cape. Red eyes? Yes, indeed, in any light nearby the eyes, which lacked the protective pigment necessary in harsh daylight, showed only the blood just under the surface of the eye. And just as some hairy monkeys on Earth have hairless, pale faces, just so did these large vampire bats have hairless faces. They were chosen by the service to self aliens because they resembled humans in the dusk. The terrified victims, frozen in fear, gave birth to the vampire myth of supernatural powers. Were they found and killed with stakes? They were killed with whatever was at hand when discovered in their dark lairs, and what was mostly at hand were wooden sticks. Farmers staking fence posts would use the pointed ends to fend off attacks from wild animals, and in most cases this was the only weapon available when fending off an attack from vampires. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. If vampires were not human, or humans turning into bats, what of werewolves? Do they exist? Humans, under the influence of the full moon, turning temporarily into wolves? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk, Werewolves, written September 1995. Werewolves exist, but not in the form portrayed in the media. The media image portrays a change in form under the influence of a full moon, and this is all quite out of the control of the human infected by a bite. A dramatization of the real situation, which happens rarely and is indeed an infection. The result of a bite, rabies. What happened in the past when a rabid animal, most often a wolf, tangled with and bit a human? Wolves normally avoid human contact, but when wildly irritable with an infected brain, they savage anything that disturbs them. The infected human first finds insidious changes setting in, irritability, snappishness. During the course of the disease, the afflicted human would become unkempt, hair and nails growing long, and in the final stages of the disease, madness and extreme irritability set in, the man having become the wolf. Why does the legend tie the madness to the full moon? Even unaffected humans grow a bit wild during the full moon, but a human in the final stages of rabies, wild-eyed and howling with pain, snarling at all who come near, would be more noticeably affected. The full moon becomes the point where it was all just too much, and quiet suffering became anguished howls. Tormented in the villages, rabid victims often sought the quiet of the woods to soothe their hyper-irritated nerves, thus the legend. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. And what of dragons, of legend in the Orient as well as Europe? Did they exist, and did they breathe fire? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on dragons, also written July 1995. Mankind has many myths about dragons throughout the world. In the Orient, the dragon is featured on pottery and in parades, and European myths are replete with knights in armor going into battle against fire-breathing dragons. The dragons invariably have wings and are shaped suspiciously like dinosaurs. Is there some basis in fact for this common human memory? Indeed there is. Where the dinosaurs died out long before mankind was engineered into being from ape stock, the Earth was not the only planet to give birth to such creatures. Evolution follows similar patterns, and where your Earth brought forth dinosaurs with wings, just so did other planets compatible with Earth. Your dragons were transplants brought to Earth by early ambassadors from the service to self, who anticipated an increased harvest of lackeys from the Earth due to the fear and despair their dragons wrought. Were the dragons intelligent and incarnated with souls? No. On a scale of 1 to 10, where the average dog is a 10, a dragon was barely a 3. This is why, in spite of the massive size and capacity to fly, as well as lumber over hill and dale, they were so easily slain, dumb brutes. Hundreds were brought to Earth and released on terrified villages. The dragons ate humans, which were neither swift runners nor able to barricade themselves in their mud huts, and were a tastier morsel than the deer, which ran fast and had taut, lean muscles. The legends speak of sacrifices, where humans would periodically offer one of their own to placate the dragon. Well, of course, this reduced the rampages, as dinner had been brought to the door. Where some dragons mated, they were scattered to begin with, and dying without progeny, eventually disappeared from the earth. There were perhaps a few hundred delivered, and their reign, ending only in the last millennia, lasted for thousands of years. The stories of dragons, all the more impressive as they were true, spread more widely than the dragons themselves. Did they breathe fire? No, but when roaring, open-mouthed, it felt like that to those within range, hot breath and a big windpipe. End of the quote from Zeta Talk 5. What of Mothman, seen in the Appalachian Mountains, a true story that even made the movies? Was he an alien or a man? Was he an intelligent alien come to warn of a pending bridge failure? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk, Mothman, recorded June 29, 2002. This true story has fascinated those who have learned of it, and thus it has made its way to Hollywood. What was this large bird man seen swooping over the mountain country, and what was its purpose? We have stated that vampires, dragons, and the recent chupas are not intelligent aliens, but more akin to dog packs, controlled by service-to-self aliens. They are brought to Earth to terrify humans, as fear pushes those inclined toward the service-to-self orientation more in that direction. Fearful humans tend to think more of themselves, ignoring empathy for others, and thus are pushed into training for entry into the service-to-self ranks, or so those service-to-self aliens hope. As dog packs, they are allowed to encounter, terrify, and even kill humans should the humans basically give up and submit. Thus, there are stories of dragons consuming virgins and vampires biting to death victims virtually drained of blood. So were the Mothmen not men at all, but bird creatures? Indeed they were, and short-lived, as they did not acclimate well to the Appalachian Mountains where they were installed. Dead, they were retrieved by their masters, as leaving bones about would lessen their impact when the brain cavity was discovered to be infinitesimal. And why the sense of doom, of a warning given by those who sighted these large birds floating overhead? This was the general vibes in the area, a sense that something unexplained was upon them, something even the church had no explanation for, and this in the Bible Belt. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Mothman. Bigfoot and the Asian equivalent, the Yeti, are sighted, but other than footprints, which can be faked, no real evidence of their existence is in hand. Are they real or just legend? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Bigfoot, written July 1995. Bigfoot has fascinated mankind for as long as the two races have been in contact with each other, as infrequent and fleeting as that may be. The reason for this has less to do with Bigfoot's size and man-ape-like appearance, which would be understandable on this earth, as with Bigfoot's elusiveness. Gorillas, for instance, are as large. Chimpanzees seem as intelligent. Why is Bigfoot a fascination? The answer lies in his seemingly uncanny ability to elude detection. The reason for this is that Bigfoot was to house a group of entities who are in quarantine. They remain elusive because they are not to intermingle with mankind. In this effort, they do not go unassisted. Bigfoot is there, right under your nose. Why are they in quarantine? These entities have been placed into a primitive condition at their request, so that they can return to a basic understanding of how to get along with each other, with nature, and ponder the wondrous workings of nature. Their quarantine is not an exile, it is a search for peace. And I quote from Zeta Talk on Yeti, written August 15, 1995. The abominable snowman, known as Yeti by the locals, is simply a variation on the Bigfoot form. Just as man migrating has evolved to fit his environment, so the Yeti adjusted to the climate when it changed after a pole shift. White fur increases the survival in snowing surroundings, like snow bunnies. Yetis born with white fur were more likely to escape predators and grow to adulthood and propagate. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Like Bigfoot, Nessie has been sighted, but no firm proof exists of her existence. True or false, does Nessie exist? I quote from Zeta Talk on the Loch Ness Monster, written August 1995. Nessie is no monster at all, but a gentle giant no more aggressive than sea cows. This species lives in numerous places around the globe, but has only come to attention in small inland lakes. Is this a freshwater creature? Yes, but one that can adapt to brackish waters. It became trapped in Loch Ness during a pole shift, where land routinely heaves up out of the sea and drops in other places below the waves. Thus trapped, the creature proceeded with its normal life, munching vegetation and fish, and occasionally popping its head above the surface to sense if it's missing any munchies. Nessie is nearly blind and relies on a sense of smell, which underwater is sensitive to chemicals in the water, but in the air catches small particles carried in the breeze. Could Nessie come out of the lake and lumber about? Hardly. This creature requires water to breathe, having gills along its sides, and thus cannot bring more than its head out of the water. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Does casting a spell curse one, and is one damned such that they cannot escape the curse? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Voodoo, written April 1996. The power of suggestion is both dismissed and held in awe by humans, who claim it might be able to affect other weak-minded individuals, but certainly not themselves. The media presents hypnosis as being able to cause individuals selected at random from an audience to make complete fools of themselves in front of the world, clucking like chickens and attempting to peck at seed, for instance. Likewise, the media shows hypnotized individuals like human time bombs walking about in human society in a normal manner, but set to explode into action when a keyword is spoken or a visual picture presented. Hypnosis, or the power of suggestion, does not work in this manner, as in all cases the individual must be in full compliance. One cannot be hypnotized to do what one does not want to do, although the suggestion can certainly be presented during hypnosis. Hypnosis encourages the conscious to relax its hold, allowing the subconscious to communicate. Any suggestions made to an individual are, perforce, being made to the subconscious, which is the solid common sense arena and processes suggestions rather than blindly accepting them. Hypnosis is used to get past the rigidities and denial imposed by the conscious, to place the conscious by the side where it can be an observer and become better integrated as a result of the discussion. That said, how does voodoo work, as indeed it does? Voodoo relies on the victim's belief systems, as without this, no magic exists. Someone who had never heard the myths, subject to all the incantations and pointing fingers and objects stolen and placed in one's personal quarters, would merely scratch their head. What's with them, they would wonder. On the other hand, humans raised in these cultures are impressed with the belief that voodoo works, palpable fear in the voices of the elders relaying the many tales. Spells cast upon humans thus primed to react set in motion a cycle of fear that can indeed kill. Fear can stop the heart by constraining arteries leading to the heart, or can drive the blood pressure to a point where blowouts occur. Cast a spell and the ashen victim is found dead in their quarters the next day. Oh, such a cooperative victim. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on voodoo. Can tarot cards foretell the future? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on tarot cards, written June 1996. Fortune tellers use many vehicles on which to place their psychic perceptions, as the bold-faced assertion that the predictions are based on what the questioner is laying before the fortune teller, like an open book, would tend to diminish the credibility of the fortune teller, and most certainly would ruin the mystique. Whether the fortune teller uses a crystal ball, I Ching, tarot cards, or reads tea leaves, the process is the same. The mind and heart of the anguished or eager human sitting across the table are what is being read, and the common sense and compassion of the psychic fortune teller are what determines the result. End of the quote on tarot cards. Likewise with Ouija boards. Is it the interpretation that counts, as tarot cards can be interpreted many ways? But the letters that emerge from a Ouija board are pretty clear. Is this a message from beyond? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Ouija boards, written January 1997. All intelligent creatures wish to know the future, and humans are no exception. They wish to divine whether the one they have their eye on is likely to return their affections, whether their fortunes will turn for the better or take a loss, whether the path they have set upon will prove to be the right choice, or whether a child they are flourishing much attention upon will meet their hopes when grown. Humans read horoscopes, tea leaves, and palms, and use any other method they can that promises, however falsely, to give them the answers they seek. It's not surprising, then, that the Ouija board is held in high regard by humans anxious to know the answer to their burning questions. The success attributed to the Ouija board methods, however, are due only to the humans whose hands direct the answers. The Ouija board is credited with spelling out known names and likely dates, when in truth, this is entirely within the control of the humans with their hands on the pointer, eyes closed or not. It takes but a moment to mentally record the pattern of letters and numbers and the distance between them. Even blindfolded, the human hand can trace what the mind remembers and sense the tension in the air when this or that target is close. For those who think that spirits are near on occasion when the Ouija board is used, this is entirely possible, as the intent of many while using the board is to call these spirits. This is indeed giving the call, and depending upon the mindset of the caller, the result may be a visit from entities in the service to self or service to other. Using the Ouija board in and of itself is not giving the call if the human understands the exercise to be simply a way of divining their subconscious wishes or knowledge. But if the human is convinced that the Ouija board is a sure link to the spirit world, and then proceeds to use the Ouija board, they are indeed giving the call. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on the Ouija board. If the Ouija board gives clues to the mindset of the human operating it, does reverse speech do the same? Can a tape or recording played backwards reveal words, the secret meaning of a speaker or musician? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on reverse speech, written January 1997. There is no such phenomenon as reverse speech, and all such discoveries are just imagination. The human body is not designed to speak intelligibly in a reverse manner, simultaneously to forward speech spoken at a different speed. The human mind perceives rolling forward and does not replay backwards, and simply is not geared that way because nature does not play things backwards. Humans evolved on Earth to deal with sights and sounds around them, not with an artificial phenomenon. Always nervous about being tempted by the devil, humans, as most intelligent species, look for signs that this is occurring. Discontent to simply rely on their intuition, they want a truth test that can be applied. It's just so much easier. As an avenue only recently detectable, due to modern electronic playback systems which can play video and audio tapes in either direction, at any speed, it has recently experienced a rush of attention which we predict will not last. In point of fact, any conversation played backwards at various speeds will sound vaguely like a recognizable speech phrase. Don't children lay on their backs in a summer day and call out shapes that the clouds assume? Don't pet owners claim their pets are talking due to the cadence of the mew or whimper? If one expects to find a phrase and plays speech or music backwards long enough and at different speeds, eventually some sound will seem to emerge that bears a faint relationship to a word or two. Where reverse speech is not truly occurring, there is another phenomenon in place in which people are trying to ascribe a physical medium for information that they understand intuitively. Human beings who are barely aware of their incarnated spirits often have knowledge that they cannot ascribe to any source. Did they hear it on TV, the radio, read it in a book, or hear it from a buddy? No, but they just simply have this information, have no explanation for where it came from. Often people are simply looking for a source. There must be some kind of logical explanation. Thus, in dealing with reverse speech, one should listen with an open heart and mind to the underlying message, which may have a great deal of truth in it. End of the quote from Theta Talk on reverse speech. Speaking in tongues is straightforward, however, if unintelligible. True or false, is the person speaking in tongues possessed by another spirit, relaying a divine message of some sort? I quote from Theta Talk on speaking in tongues, written May 1997. A long-running theme in Christianity is the fainting or babbling hysteria that on occasion overcomes nuns. Where other religious practices such as voodoo have an equivalent, such as the dancing frenzy that ends in a short coma, this is an activity and result that is deliberately encouraged. Christian frenzies are notable for appearing to be visited upon the faithful as something they neither desired or encouraged, and most certainly not something they incited. The self and the sexual inhibitions the Christian church often imposes are precisely the source, however. Even religions as repressive as Islam have sexual outlets unsinkable in Christian doctrine. Christianity states that sex is wrong, per se, and should only be indulged in when self-discipline breaks down. Masturbation, an utterly harmless and completely natural activity, is postured as a sin against nature. Those who must indulge are funneled into marriage, their only outlet, and then only a marriage blessed by the church. For Catholics, this is also a single marriage during a lifetime. Then there is the matter of contraception, where those Catholics who allow themselves to indulge in sex in their proscribed single marriage in a lifetime must also allow as many children as possible to result. And those who would sidestep these restrictions into homosexual alliances are damned to burn in hell. These strictures mean that very few Christians, and in particular very few Catholics, will have any guilt-free sexual outlet. All other outlets than a proper marriage with a single lifetime spouse without benefit of contraception bring with it all manner of baggage. The conflicts are endless, and the specter of burning in hell raised up for the mere thought of getting out of the bind. Thus, good Catholics try not to think about it, try to have a sex-free life in spite of their hormones, and some go into the monasteries and nunneries hoping the environment will help them in this regard. Speaking in tongues or dancing in circles is nothing more than an outlet, the equivalent of a cold shower or long run, but with some added benefits. The practitioner has an orgasm. The church allows this form of masturbation, giving oneself over into antics that incite an orgasm, as it is presented as a religious fervor rather than what it is, sexual fervor. Bumping about, falling to the floor, pelvic thrusts, waving arms, extemporaneous cries of joy. Take away the church setting and what do you see? End of the quote from Zeta Talk. But surely in Stigmata, something real has emerged, something a human cannot do to themselves, something divine. True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Stigmata, written September 1999. The body can create stigmata through a force of will. This is often suspected. A great deal of illness, almost the majority, is caused by what is termed psychosomatic problems, tension, or a decision by the person to become ill, as astonishing as this may seem. There are a great many autoimmune diseases, infection that just doesn't seem to heal, that antibiotics can't suppress, so the infection overwhelms. Cancer itself is a decision by the body to die. If inflammation can be caused by the will, then why can't a person cause an inflammation to the point of burst capillaries in the center of one's palm? This is quite possible. People who walk on hot coals who are able to hold their breath and be almost buried alive and manage to be dredged up hours later, they have learned to control their bodies as the yogis do. This is not all that unusual. It's not common, but it's not all that unusual. People who have great faith and wish to join with the ascetics, with the saints, to merge with them and be dead before their time, will often take on those physical forms that make their life on earth more similar to where they wish to be with their admired ones. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Stigmata. Did Atlantis exist, and what about its Pacific equivalent, Lemuria, the land of Mu? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Atlantis, written August 1995. Many cities in and around the European continent went under the waves during the past few pole shifts. This is because the Atlantic, as a widening ocean, tends to drag down the shorelines and outlying islands during each shift. The floor of the Atlantic drops, pulling its perimeter with it. Rumors of Atlantis aside, mankind did not achieve advances beyond what they hold today in the past. Atlantis was not a human society, but a society composed, dominated, by the advanced hominoids from Planet X. They used crystals for communication, had rocket power, but these equated to no more than mankind has today. And I quote from The Land of Mu, written also in August 1995. In concert with the legends of Atlantis are the legends of Mu, a land somewhere in the Pacific which is supposed to reappear at some troubled point in the future, like a paradise that the troubled can flock to. Does this legend have a basis in fact, past, or future? It does indeed, in that such a land was above the waves in the past, disappearing during one of the recent wrenching pole shifts that rearranged the continents and forces plates up above one another or under in sudden subduction with loss of elevation. There are many points on the Pacific where land is not that far under the ocean, and the evidence of roads lies just under the waves off the coast of Japan, which bears witness to land even along the Pacific Rim being forced down during the shortening and compression that the Pacific experiences during severe pole shifts. Mu was as peaceful as many of the islands in the Pacific, the people living an indolent and relatively worry-free life in a warm climate, with the abundance that the ocean provides to those living along its coastlines. Its residents enjoyed the social freedoms that such easy living often bring, as there was little reason for war or restrictions. There was, however, nothing magical about this land or its peoples. No special spiritual qualities or technological advantages, regardless of how the legends might have been embellished over time. Nor will this land reappear during the forthcoming pole shift. The Pacific, in fact, will be a dangerous and severely afflicted part of the globe during the coming shift, and any advice to the contrary is misleading. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on the Land of Mu. Did I hear mention of crystals for communications used by the Atlanteans? Do crystals have magical properties? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Crystals, written September 1995. Crystals do have what humans would call magical properties, as they don't know how else to explain the results. Crystals capture and focus energies that mankind is not aware of as yet. These energies cannot be seen and measured, yet their presence leaves its mark. Like most myth-makers, crystals have given life to stories that bear no relationship to the truth. It has been reported that crystals can prevent disease, grow sturdier plants, and affect the passage of time. Only the latter is true, but this cannot be put to any practical use. Not all crystals have this effect, and a certain size must be attained before any effect at all occurs. A synergy is in process. It has been reported that the lost city of Atlantis used large crystals, and that such a crystal lying under the waves in the Bermuda Triangle is causing havoc. None of this is true. Crystals of any size or shape, or of whatever nature, are not having any significant effect on mankind or on the earth at the present time, and any reports to the contrary are false. Crystals have at times been used as a communication booster by various alien groups, but for no other reason. These crystals left on the surface of Mars or the Moon, or even here and there on Earth, are not being activated at the current time, and thus have no more influence on their surroundings than other inanimate objects. These crystals are immense, as large as a pickup truck, and flawless. Humans are incapable of building them, and should they uncover one on Earth, they would be incapable of activating it. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on crystals. So what does have the effects reported in the Bermuda Triangle? Lost ships, lost planes, and reports of things disappearing before one's eyes. True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on the Bermuda Triangle, written July 1995. The Bermuda Triangle does indeed have unusual qualities, as do other places here and there on Earth. Magnetic anomalies are reported, where compasses swing wildly, clocks stop, and concrete objects fade from sight. What's causing this? These places, fortunately few in number, are an outlet from the center of the Earth for a byproduct of the Earth's compression, a gravity byproduct, so to speak. A vent from where subatomic particles not known to man surge periodically, and woe to the man or fish who finds itself in the way. There are stories of ships and planes disappearing, and it is assumed they were carried off by extraterrestrials, taken off to a far-off zoo for exhibition. Then why would these only disappear from such sites, and not regularly around the globe? Here and there around the face of the Earth are similar outlets for this byproduct of the Earth's compression, many of them well known due to the havoc shippers or travelers experience, an area off the coast of Japan and in one of the Great Lakes, for example. Such outlets also occur where man is unaware of them, as in the depths of the oceans or within inaccessible mountain crevices. What determines the outlet is not only the surface structure of the rock, fractures in fact, but also the structure of the underlying rock, factors man cannot measure. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on the Bermuda Triangle. If pole shifts cause land to rise and fall, and Antarctica gives evidence of once having been tropical, are the stories about an underground base there true, and Admiral Byrd's visits there true? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Antarctica, written January 1996. Rumors of an underground base in Antarctica, where elite members of the Third Reich fled toward the end of World War II, are based in part on the flight of many Nazis to the far reaches of South America. Parlaying on this widely known fact, those who wish to spread myths about an alien support of governments engaged in activities generally held to be evil have constructed a story few, if any, could ever disprove. How many people can go to Antarctica and trudge around in search of this fabulous place? A safe and wholly untrue rumor. And I quote from Zeta Talk on Admiral Byrd, written December 1995. Admiral Byrd, now dead, cannot refute any of the stories being spread about extraneous activities during his trips to the South Pole. The famous story about his widow having a sudden change of heart and pulling a letter from his coffin, handing this to his grandson, is now firmly in ufology lore. Admiral Byrd did not have contact with spaceships or trips to underground cities, but disproving the proposition is unlikely to happen. This is a safe story, as the proposition cannot be disproved. Like the MJ-12 papers, a good forgery, the log might be examined but would be inconclusive in either direction. Safe. Like the fantasy in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the concept of living in bubble cities under the ocean or warm and well-lighted caverns intrigues humans, as this is an expansion of their living space. Humans trudging through rain and snow, picking up after tornadoes and hurricanes, and dealing with skin cancer find relief in this fantasy. However, in the context of the alien presence, the intrigue goes beyond this diversion. Humans hearing threats of a mass landing, which we have explained would not be allowed to occur, have their anxieties lessened by such stories of secret cultures already on the Earth. Heck, why worry? They're already here. With a sigh of relief, the populace is supposed to come to the realization that cohabitation has not harmed them to date, so there's no need to worry. An elaborate tranquilizer. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Admiral Byrd. What about things that can be visited, like Stonehenge? Were humans sacrificed there? Astronomical sightings? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Stonehenge, written July 1995. Stonehenge is ancient, far older than man assumes. Its purpose is confused because of its age. Was it a sacrificial site? Was it an astronomical measure? Was it simply a place for lovers to meet in the moonlight? No records remain. No peoples remain in whose memory Stonehenge has a place. It stands bleak and cold, its secrets a mystery so deep that none can fathom them. Yet the mystery is easily answered if the ages are taken into account. Stonehenge is older than the wandering of the cavemen, mankind's earliest numbers. It is so early that no cultural memory remains that can strike a chord. Stonehenge has survived prior cataclysms due to being situated on solid rock and the careful placement of the stones. Solid rock receives a single jolt during a single earthquake, and upright stones are prevented from toppling if held at the top, and capping stones lining the top are prevented from falling as they are lined end to end, and the ends brace each other. Nevertheless, several Stonehenge massives have toppled. What caused these stones to topple? The wind? Have the man-made statues around London toppled due to earthquakes in England? Clearly, Stonehenge has experienced earthquake trauma. Where much has been made of Stonehenge being oriented to the sun at certain times of the year, such that it appears to be a type of sundial, some such orientation would occur no matter what the location of the stones were. The time of the year would simply change. Stonehenge is not a sundial, nor an astronomical measuring device, nor a place of worship or sacrifice, nor a meeting ground. These explanations are mankind's attempts to explain Stonehenge, as the true explanation is too discomforting. So just what is Stonehenge? Stonehenge was built to the specifications of a reptilian king who resided on Earth so long ago that humans were scarcely emerging. Yet the structure was to carry meaning for the emerging humans, which it has to this day. Subliminal messages of power and sadistic treatment toward those sacrificed. Humans look upon Stonehenge and imagine the innocent struggling on the table under the knife. Why else would there be a table? They imagine a coven of evil surrounding them. Why else would there be a circle? They imagine no force on its way to rescue the victim. Why else would all this be in the open? Stonehenge was built to fulfill the purpose it has, to insinuate itself into the subconscious of mankind, making it uneasy. This was done by the Service to Self crowd, who hoped to win converts among the emerging souls of man. And to the quote from Zeta Talk on Stonehenge. The pyramids were built more recently, though, and are rumored to be everything from burial chambers to astronomical sighting devices to elaborate calendars pointing to the end times. True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on the pyramids, written October 1996. There has been endless speculation about the giant pyramids and the pyramid shape in general, as the reason ancient pyramids were built is unknown. The reason the shape was chosen is so simple that it has been overlooked as being too obvious. The shape endures through earthquakes, and great height is easier to attain than with a rectangular shape, as sheer walls where heavy objects must be lifted rather than dragged is avoided. Primarily, the ability of the pyramid to endure over thousands of years made it the shape of choice. The giant pyramids were astronomical devices to assist those left behind to mine Earth in determining when the next passage of Planet X was nigh. Pyramid cults have sprung up that claim almost magical results from operations done under a pyramid shape. This is nonsense, as beyond air circulation under a roof or the ability to drain rainwater, the shape of the roof is irrelevant. Do light rays or radio waves consider the shape of the walls or roof they encounter, avoiding some shapes and being altered by others? The material a shape is composed of may matter, but not the shape. All claims to the contrary. For those who claim that health improved or plants grew faster or whatever under a pyramid-shaped roof, we will point out that the health of mankind is greatly subject to psychological influences, and the eye often sees what it wishes to behold. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on pyramids. Theories abound about Jack the Ripper. Who was he? Such brutal crimes yet never brought to justice. Was he a royal prince as rumored, thus protected? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Jack the Ripper, written October 1996. During the era when Jack the Ripper did his deeds, there was much interest in the human organs, their function, and the potential for playing God by piecing a human together with the best of this or that. The difficulties doctors faced when transplanting organs that soon are rejected by the new host were unknown to doctors and scientists during that era. That the story of the Frankenstein monster arose during that era is indicative of the interest in this subject. Where the story of a living monster, pieced together from body parts harvested from the dead or living, is fiction, the story of attempts to create such a monster is not fiction. There were many Dr. Frankensteins, and as doctors came from the upper classes during that era, they were well connected. The identity of Jack the Ripper is not known to the public, but was known to the authorities, at least those who made the decision on whether to pursue a line of investigation or the path that investigation was to take. The influence that the upper classes had on the police and regulatory agencies is not new, and pressure to look the other way or financial inducements have always been a facet of human society. The rumor that the perpetrator was royalty was spread to explain why the authorities had little luck. The common man could comprehend a reluctance to indict royalty, and that royalty would be able to suppress an investigation. Jack the Ripper was not one man, but a group of scientists and doctors, actively pursuing in real life what Dr. Frankenstein was pursuing in fiction. Fresh corpses were routinely delivered to medical schools for autopsy practice and the training of students, so harvesting fresh organs from the recently deceased was not difficult. However, when those wishing to play God found that dead organs only resulted in a dead body, they sought living organs. Prostitutes were easy prey, as they could be relied upon to follow a client into a dark alley willingly. Being the weaker sex, they also were anticipated to put up less of a struggle. Each failure to create life from dead or dying body parts was followed by yet another experiment, until the group finally despaired. Were they to have had success, however modest, Jack the Ripper might be with us still today, as at no time did the group feel any compunction to curtail their activities. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Jack the Ripper. Well, what about the devil? A real creature or just another archetype? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on the Devil, written July 1995. The devil is reputed to be a red creature with a pointed tail and two horns, most often carrying a three-pronged fork. Is this a mythological creature or does it have a basis in reality? And if so, how did it come to be associated with evil? In fact, the devil is not far in description from a real creature who lives and breathes today, albeit not on Earth. This creature visited Earth in the past and, to say the least, made an impression. Why the three-pronged fork? And does the number three have a significance? It does indeed. The Devil of Lore is a fairly accurate picture of an extraterrestrial who visited Earth millennia ago, briefly. This visit preceded the time when the Bible was to be written, and thus the memories of this entity were fresh and strong. This was an entity who came alone, except for his entourage, in answer to the call from a group of humans strongly oriented towards service to self. This call was given in mid-Africa, but once called, this entity roamed about a bit, answering the call from others in the vicinity. He is indeed red all over, and to humans in close contact he would seem to exude heat. Thus he was associated with the concept of fire, as one who could live comfortably within fire. His personality, to those in contact with him, seemed fiery also, given to flashes of temper and severe punishments. The devil. This entity came to Earth with an entourage, a threesome, who carried pointed sticks used for communications. They stood at attention, to the rear or the side of their master, as the service to self orientation requires a strict pecking order. Their sticks were all in a row, pointed upwards. Humans saw this as a threat, as weapons that could be pointed toward them or used to prod them. Thus the three-pronged pointed fork. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on the Devil. Well, so, can we expect the Antichrist to be a real person too? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on the Antichrist, written July 1995. The Antichrist represents the last-minute struggle for the souls of men by those in the service to self. Those in stable positions of power in the service to self camps to secure recruits increases as calamity increases. They have always planned to hover about the earth at this time so as to answer the call in the strongest manner possible, to leverage every opportunity to the max, as you say. Is there a single individual who will incarnate at this time and lead, as some have speculated? No. Unless this occurs due to a walk-in or possession, service-to-self entities from other worlds cannot incarnate into human form at this time. Only those in the service to others can do so, as this is the overweening orientation of the earth and also of the earth's future. The Antichrist concept, being vague, has taken shape in the minds of those who hear this prophecy as either a single charismatic leader, a group following such a leader, or property and people who carry an ownership mark, the mark of the beast. None of these are true, as the battle is on an individual basis, within each individual human encouraged to follow the service-to-self path. The Antichrist represents, by parable, what is occurring now and has been for some years, the battle for men's souls during the end times, the time going into the cataclysms, and the years in the aftertime, all of which is the transformation period, and this time is now. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on the Antichrist. Well, certainly Orson Welles was a real person. What were the motives behind his radio show, War of the Worlds? Was this some kind of test? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Orson Welles, written May 1997. The presentation of the radio drama War of the Worlds some decades ago in the United States was, as many have expected, a test. Given that the alien presence had up until that time been consistently presented as an alien threat, the public reaction was hardly surprising. Radio dramas are often confused with reality by those tuning in, as there are few clues that a fiction rather than a factual scene is being portrayed. On TV, the fact that one is watching a movie is quickly apparent. There are clues in the setting, the time gaps and leaps, and the frequent intimate moments which newscasters are not generally privy to. Thus, had War of the Worlds been presented on TV at that time, rather than as a radio drama, the reaction would not have been the same. This test, which the establishment knew would be taken for a real broadcast by many, was to determine not how the public would react to a threat, but rather to determine if they believed in the alien presence. They did, and thus they reacted, and the strength of the reaction told the establishment, which had been congratulating themselves on having suppressed belief in aliens, that they had not succeeded as they thought. The few suicides that the broadcast caused and the potential heart attacks were not a concern to the establishment at that time, as they considered themselves to be essentially at war and the nation, in essence, under martial law. All rules of human conduct go out the window when the leadership is themselves in a panic. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Orson Welles and War of the Worlds. Did Tesla get his information from aliens, and was he onto something huge? True or false? My quote from Zeta Talk on Tesla, written November 15, 1995. Tesla was a genius given to grandiose plans, all of which failed. He did indeed ask for assistance from Service to Self aliens, giving the call, and many of his insights were due to conferences with these aliens, who found him remarkably gullible. Tesla absolutely believed in what he was purporting and became a salesman with remarkably persuasive abilities. The Service to Self aliens who toyed with Tesla knew that they would not be allowed to give Tesla real technology or knowledge, factors that would trip the balance between the orientations. However, lying to Tesla and setting him off to set the stage for more of such games with humans is within the bounds they are allowed to operate within. So they lied, and Tesla's eyes lit up, and just as expected, Tesla ran around gathering disciples and sponsors. To this day, there are humans who firmly believe he was onto something and pursue his theories. Tesla postulated that electrical energy would be harnessed to the degree that it could be captured as free energy and likewise redirected as free energy. He was given enough information from Service to Self aliens who answered his call to be able to demonstrate these theories in a preliminary manner, using concepts and devices new to the science field. Therein lay his fame, and therein lies the tenacity of his disciples. However, the Holy Grail they seek is not down the path they have been set upon. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Tesla. Speaking of aliens, the rumor about Chernobyl is that UFOs were seen in the area at that time. Did they have a hand in it? True or false? I quote from Zeta Talk on Chernobyl, written September 21st, 2002. Chernobyl was allowed to occur as the elite in those days, in particular the elite of Russia, were out of touch with the reality of nuclear disasters. They needed a reality touch, so the normal brakes we and our brethren in the Service to Other had been applying were taken off. An accident that would have happened without these brakes allowed. This affected, horrifically, those in the immediate vicinity. This also affected many in the European arena, as the dust blew about and panic was high in the populace. The effect was that Russia was horrified, drawn up sharply in their aggressive plans, and a leadership hardly casual about reigning in the warmongers among them. There have been reports in the Russian press that UFOs were sighted above Chernobyl, and a suspected intervention in the complete meltdown of the reactors done. This is true. End of the quote from Zeta Talk on Chernobyl. That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.